Welcome to the 16th Conversation on Buddha Nature. I'm Marcus Perman, Executive Director of Tsadar Foundation. Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature, hosted by Tsadar Foundation in association with the educational resource website, buddhanature.org. For this event, our regular host, Lopan Dr. Karma Phunso, will speak with the Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Kempo Tenzin Norgye Rinpoche. You can watch all the past events on the buddhanature.org resource website, and they're now available as both video and audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. So please feel free to send questions with the Q&A function on Zoom, or if you're on Facebook, use the comments. And we'll have a time set aside for questions with the speakers at the end. We're honored to have Kempo Tenzin Norgye with us here today. Thank you. Kempo Tenzin Norgye studied and became a teacher at Nagyur Nyingma Institute at Namdroling Monastery in Myanmar. At the institute, he studied under Kenshin Pema Sherab, Kempo Namdro Tsering, Kenshin Tsewang Gyatso, and other visiting teachers, including Kenshin Jigme Punso and Kempo Pema Tsewang from Tibet. He was formally enthroned as Kempo by His Holiness Pena Rinpoche in 1998, and he was assigned by His Holiness to teach at the Buddhist College at Palyo Monastery in Tibet. Later, he came to the United States and is now the main resident master at Palyo Dharma Center in the New York City metro area. As you all know, Lopan Dr. Karma Phunso is the recipient of Tsadar Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddha Nature Studies and is our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karma Phunso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He's the founder of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Kempo Tenzin Norgye Rinpoche joining us from New York and Karma Phunso joining us from Bhutan. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. And Kuzu Zangpo to Rinpoche and everyone who has joined us today. Before we begin this session, in the tradition of the monastic Buddhist monastic education, let's cultivate the altruistic intention. Let's give a moment to cultivate bodhicitta with the wish that this session and whatever we do brings benefit and happiness to both oneself and others. Rinpoche, Kuzu Zangpo, and thank you for joining us. It has been quite a number of years since we saw each other. You couldn't come to Bhutan. I couldn't go out of Bhutan because of the COVID pandemic. But it's nonetheless a great honor and pleasure to have you here with us virtually. And you've given your background, you went to secular school in Bhutan as a young boy, and then you went to Namdroling to go through the traditional Shedra training, and you're a senior colleague to me. And then you have been teaching in India, in Namdroling, and also Palyul Monastery in Bir, and in Tibet, the main Palyul Monastery in Tibet. And now you're teaching in the West. And I also hear you're teaching Jui Lama, the ultimate continuum, to your students in New York City. So it's so appropriate for us to have you to talk about Buddha nature and the ultimate continuum. So Rinpoche, as usual, I would like to begin by asking you when you first encountered this idea, this concept, the teachings on Buddha nature. And what can you recall of those days? And then ever since, how has Buddha nature been part of your spiritual practice and spiritual work? If you can share your memories of that, and through that, basically tell us a little about your own spiritual journey.
Thank you for inviting to this conversation. I feel honored. And as I was telling you in our private conversation here, I was mostly talking about Mondo and more practitioner on practice base, you know, not really studying this scholarly academic studies for some time. So I was feeling a little bit, you know, kind of maybe how I can present it. Anyhow, I accepted it. And as I said just now, feel honored to talk about Buddha nature, because as a Mahayana Buddhist practitioner, I think we should pay full attention to Buddha nature. And when I saw your program, actually, I was very happy. And around the same time, I was also thinking to give this teaching on Ji Lama, you know, ultimate continuum. And so to answer your question, the first time that I heard about Buddha nature was maybe even the first class in our Namdoling Sheda, you know, when I started somehow Domsum, you know, the three vows was given before studying Bodhicharya Avatara. So there, in the very beginning of Domsum, it starts with, you know, Dzogba Chenpo Yeshe Chi, Yongsu Dago Doji Changchenpo. So that time, then I was, of course, before, I just thought to become Buddha is almost transforming yourself to something, someone whom you are not, you know. And then when I was told about this, you know, the Jiangxi, the base of purification, then path and Jiangde, the fruition. So it was from then onward, it was very interesting to see that, understand or to listen to that to become Buddha is not something kind of like you are inventing or creating something new. So it was basically that you have that potential, or in higher teaching, even in this very moment, you are Buddha, but just we got distorted, you know? And because of that, then we are wandering in this cyclic existence, samsara, and now to just be able to understand the Buddha nature through that, then actually you're becoming who you are, you know? So this is one joke that I used to say, that becoming Buddha is actually to be who we are. So that was very a very interesting point that I got maybe in my first or second class when I just began studying our Sheda.
So Kembola, when you say Buddha nature is really becoming or being who you are, or being sort of in your nature, a lot of the people in the audience would probably have this question: what is the nature? You know, who are we? Can you give a very sort of a brief, concise explanation of how you see from the Nyingma tradition as our true nature, the Buddha nature?
Yeah, so Buddha nature, or generally, what is nature is, as said by Nagarjuna, right? Rangshin Dang, Jemin Dak, Shenla Deba Mibichir. So maybe these are the two reasons we can say that, you know, what is natural and is not being relying on, is not conditioned. So that has to be who you are, not just because of what you're in regular terms, how you're educated, how in which culture that you're born, and how all your upbringings and education and all this doesn't make who you are. So then who you are is supposed to be something that is there, always unchanging. And, you know, whether you are a child, so it is there, or whether you get old, it's there. And whether you are educated or non-educated, or East or West, So there is some kind of an essence that is there ever, in one sense, ever present. So that has to be the nature which is uncontrived. And in that way, then, you know, when I say to be who we are, of course, it can have different meanings, right? But so it has to be some of your own intuitive feeling where you think that, this is something uncontrived and it should at least last for, you know, of course, if we talk just about this life, at least for your lifetime, you know, not there, then it is who you are. Otherwise, in every decade, if you change that who you are, that means it's changing and that doesn't represent who you really are. This is what I feel.
Yes. So, Kimbo, you know, when we talk about this sort of uncontrived true nature of sentient beings, the true nature that we are, often this is presented in different ways. You have some people presenting that through the aspect of emptiness, of how we are empty of inherent existence. Then there are also scholars who present it through luminosity, through the clarity and the lucidity of the mind. And then you have this, of course, known in Kagyu and Nyingma, particularly of the union of emptiness and luminosity. Can you tell a little bit more about how Buddha nature, as the nature of one's mind, is presented in the Nyingma tradition?
Yeah, in Nyingma tradition, especially in the inner Tantra teachings, then it's presented in terms of like Shiju, right? The ground Tantra, or basically Shiju Rangshin Hingi Tupi Kilkho, which is kind of like spontaneously present mandala, which is saying that now there's a complete, not only just as a seed to Buddha nature, Buddhahood, but all the qualities of the kayas and the wisdom mind are present in this, the our ground. And that can be, I think, presented according Mahayana, where is mostly, I would say, I'm sorry, Mahayoga, where you see that in the in Sanyin, was that Guryagarbha?
Guryagarbha.
Yeah, Guryagarbha Tantra, where is explaining the in detail the existence of all these kayas and wisdom mind within our nature of our mind. Then as you go higher, then in Dzogchen, then looks like it is almost like a different, Dzogchen has, how should say, more specific method on how a teacher can introduce to the student in a unique pit instruction method to be able to recognize the Buddha nature, even though you are an ordinary person. Whereas, as you know, that sutra teaching is saying that even in Jyut Lama is saying that Buddha nature cannot be clearly understood by even the Bodhisattva in 10th Bhumi, right? So, so we, Nyingmapas found a way to bypass all this and
So, one thing that you find in the Nyingma tradition is Buddha nature is studied primarily through the tantras, and particularly through the inner yogas, the inner tantras, Mahayoga, Anuyoga, and Atiyoga tantras. So there seems to be so much focus on studying Buddha nature through the tantras, starting all the way from, say, Padmasambhava's Mengatawe Tengwa, Garland of Views, And then, of course, you find, as you pointed out, the teachings in tantras like Guhyagarbha Tantra, and then also coming down through Rongzom or Longchenpa or Jimilingpa until Mipham's times. Even how you mentioned earlier, right at the beginning, that you first heard about Buddha nature through ascertaining the three vows by Naripenchen Pema Wangel. Now, the first chapter is talking about the nine jhanas and sort of brings very sort of directly the idea of how we are primordially already Buddhas. So is it fair to say Buddha nature is mostly studied in the Nyingma tradition through tantras? Can you tell basically a little bit more about how Buddha nature is studied in the Nyingma tradition, particularly in the Shedras where you taught?
Yeah, well, so in all the Shedras, as you also, you know, the curriculums are pretty much same, right? Mm-hmm. And when we study about Buddha nature, then other than in Jitlama, which is, you know, we study for a few months only, and then in the past also, as a, you know, somehow Nyingmapa were not that much emphasizing on sutra teachings generally. And of course, question then in that way, then the study on Jilama was in the same way as it falls in the sutra, you know, class. So maybe that was emphasized. But then either, as I said just now, through the pit instruction practices, or in when you're studying in, you know, you can see even in the Tantra also, maybe during the time of Longchenpa and Rongzom was very, I would say, very vibrant or, you know, taken. But then maybe there was a decline, you know, until maybe Milling Yapse time, right? And then again, there was maybe another decline or not that much emphasized. And then, you know, until the time of Kempo Shenga and there was another revival of further studying, and especially during Kempo Shenga and Mihwan Rinpoche's time, then, you know, Nyingmapas also studied both, you know, Tonga Sungjuk, the studies. And before that was mostly, looks like, you know, as per our chronological studies, and mostly emphasizing on the tantras. And then maybe it is, so why it is so is because in tantra is expressed more, you know, self-jetsoksum, clear and in detailed explanation of the Buddha nature. So that's why I guess in Nyingma tradition, the ones who have a clear explanation, a teaching which is giving a clear explanation on Buddha nature. So then maybe Jitlama and all this was not that much emphasized, like, you know, some, especially Kaji. I think they emphasize Jitlama a lot, right?
Yes. Yeah, so we do find that difference, don't we, that in the, particularly say the Gelugpa tradition, Buddha nature is primarily approached or studied through the topic of Rik, of the spiritual gene, as part of their long study of Maitreya's Abhisamaya Alankara, the ornament of direct realization. When they do that particular text, they give a lot of time to the study of Rik or Gotra, the spiritual gene. And then in the Kaju, you definitely find so much focus on Jilama. And in Nyingma, it's interestingly, there's not so much focus on Jilama or the Rik in Abhisamaya Alankara. But I find your explanation very convincing, that you go straight to the tantric presentation of Buddha nature, because there it is much more elaborate, much more clear, and much more complete. And actually, in a lot of Nyingma writings, one of the things you find is the chapter on the Shi, no, the Shiju. Like in Longchenpa's writings, they often start with the chapter on the sort of primordial ground from where we start. Then the same also with some Gatok Lamas, like Thekpi Chidel of Gatok Tamba Deshek. Quite a lot of Nyingma teachings seem to start from a chapter on Shi. So quite interesting that the Nyingmapas use the tantric perspective and focus more on that. What would have inspired people like Kempo Shenga, Shenpen Shukin Nangwa, who is the one behind the creation of the 13 great treatises, Shungchen Chusum, as a curriculum for Kshetras, and then also Mipham, who wrote on Buddha nature primarily from this sutra perspective? What would have inspired them to do that from sutra perspective, moving away from the traditional tantric perspective that other Nyingma masters had before them? Any idea?
I think I would just say because of two reasons. One reason was we had that, but we lost it in the time of Kenlop Chösum. Then it is very clear that the sutras were studied, and then even Tezon Dezen has a commentary on the Tema also, right? So he like that, and then his son Hase Damsin was a translator, right? Hase Lotsawa. So in that way, it looks like both the sutras and tantras were studied in the very beginning, even emphasizing on the tema, the logic. Mm. So that was how it looks like it started. Mm. But then afterwards, because of the time when it declined, and then through the revival in the maybe around 11th century or so, then most of the teachings were based on, I would say, focusing mostly on the Dharma teachings, right? So most of the Dharma teachings, and of course we had the Kama and all this. And then it was lost for some time, I think, because people were mostly focused on the practices of these Dharma teachings.
Hmm.
And then maybe during the time of Shenga and Mipham Rinpoche, then maybe just in one sense was then when Tsongkhapa started Gelug tradition, and then they presented the sutra in a different way than how Nyingmapa would understand. And as we read in, Mipham Rinpoche's many of his writings, saying that Shenla Tamchu Tawa. So you don't have to be, excited or stimulated by other philosophical presentation. We ourselves have this our own unique way of presenting, and in that way I think it was a way to react to how the Nyingmapas, when they wanted to, looks like in one time the Nyingmapas, when you want to study sutra, you had to go to mostly, I would say, Gelug monasteries to study sutra. And when they came back to Nyingma monasteries, so they had this view of how Tsongkhapa has presented the sutra's view, and that didn't match with what is being written in the sutra's view in the seven trenchers of Longchenpa and Rongsom. So that's why to show that we have our own unique way of presenting the sutra teachings. So that's why I think then Kempo Shenga Kempushenga maybe mostly on the Indian writings, right? But Mihon is mostly clarifying the points of Longchenpa's tenet system.
I would also add that, you know, so in addition to having a kind of a reactionary sort of movement to counteract the Gelugpa hegemony in that part of Kham, particularly where Shenga and Mipham lived, I think in addition to that, then especially in the case of Shenga, there seemed to be also a push to go back to the originals, you know, to not be bogged down by the local Tibetan interpretations that were very sort of specious, very wordy, but instead to go back to the originals using Indian commentaries, and then through that approach, a more way of looking at texts without too much of sectarian interpretations. So would you say that it, both in case of Mipham and Shenga, there was also that Rime approach to go back to some original Indian commentaries and not be bogged down by Tibetan differences?
Yeah, that was definitely true. We can read in, especially in the writings of Mipham Rinpoche. So he refutes Tsongkhapa or any other masters. And in the he concludes most of the debates by saying that actually we land up in the same place. And he's maybe the one of the scholars who refutes Tsongkhapa, but says that ultimately the Tsongkhapa's view and Nyingmapa's view are same, you know, not like other, you know, others who refute Tsongkhapa saying that you have went totally wrong. So he presented that just to get an attention for the beginners, but ultimately it, you know, our view are same. So maybe he's only that also representing a Rimi presentation. So that is how I see it. You
know? Yes. So in that respect, then, you know, for instance, when we look at Buddha nature studies and Buddha nature discussions in Tibet, you have on one hand the Rangtong camp, you know, people who argue that even Buddha nature is empty of its own inherent existence. And in fact, in some cases, that Buddha nature doesn't even have the Buddha qualities latent in it. And then on the other hand, you have the Shentongpas, particularly the Jonangpas, who would argue that Buddha nature, the nature of our mind, actually is endowed with all the enlightened qualities of the Buddha and is eternal and absolute and real. So among Nyingmapas also, you find variations of these, right? How would you see, for instance, the position of Longchenpa or Mipham or Rongzom in this sort of range of understanding Buddha nature?
Yeah, so it seems like it's just a way, you know, just a way of emphasizing, you know, some want to emphasize more on emptiness and some wants to emphasize more on, Western luminosity. And because of that reason, maybe it would be just a way of, emphasizing which one is, depending upon their own view.
So let me ask you a more specific question, Gimbula. So a lot of people think Mipham was a Shentongpa. He argued for the concept of other emptiness because he wrote The Lion's Roar in defense of the Shentong view. I personally don't think that he's a Shentongpa, but he wrote that as a defense for the Shentongpas who are being harassed by others. Yes. What is your take on what Mipham's position is?
I think Mipham is always on the union of both, you know, Rangtong and Shentong to be, you know, he wants to unite generally, not just in a, you know, to be politically correct. I think his view, as we read in, you know, generally in his, you know, many writings, so always saying that, you know, like two sides of the coin, you know, one is the emptiness, another is the clarity, and then to understand Buddha nature clearly, then one has to understand what is emptiness, one has to understand what is clarity, and then the union of clarity and emptiness would be a complete presentation. And then I think why he wrote this, you know, Shentong Helen Singing Naro, so he is kind of saying that, you know, that looks like the essence of it is Pumba Pumbi Mitong Pumba Dendu Kitong, right? So he was, is not empty of words, but is empty of words, inherent existence. Then he's applying that in the same way. Then Shentong was also saying the same thing, no? Buddha nature is not empty of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is empty of inherent existence. Mm. But that is, then you guys land up in the same place. No?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you, I think if I remember correctly, one, the Shentong tradition, so the Junangpas who argue Buddha nature is not empty of Buddha nature itself, he would call them Dengi Shentong, Buddha nature being empty of other adventitious afflictions and so on. And then I think the Gelugpa interpretation, Vas being not empty of vastness, but of inherent existence, he calls word Shentong, no? Tsigi Shentong, something like that.
Yeah, that I can think Shentong means that it basically means that, yeah, they use that, but they'd land up in the Shentong ultimately as Shentong. Just to add on it, so I always used to think, you know, in our Sheda too, when I was talking about what is, when we were studying about what is Tangden, or provisional meaning, then Nyeden, definitive. So if someone, you know, like accepts Tantra as the Nyeden, definitive meaning, then I see a big contradiction. Then why, in that case, why not the third turning is the definitive meaning? Because, you know, is both of the, talking about the same subject on this vessel, the luminosity. So that one, I always used to think that there's a big contradiction. If you say that Tantra is, you know, definitive meaning, then you say that turning is provisional. You know, somehow in my mind doesn't match.
So suppose in other traditions, even in traditions like Sakya and Gelug, where on the sutra level, the Buddha nature teachings and Buddha nature sutras are sometimes considered as provisional, but then a tantra like Guhyagarbha or Hevajra will be considered as definitive meaning. And in fact, if you look at the content, what Guhyagarbha teaches, what Guhyasamaja teaches is how, say, the four, five elements are also by nature Buddhas. And that's what you find in some ways in the Buddha nature sutras, talking about sentient beings, now how sentient beings are already Buddhas. So yes, I can see that, that even in case of somebody like Chandrakirti, you know, a lot of people will think that Chandrakirti argues personally that the Buddha nature teachings should be considered as provisional, because that's what he says in his Entering the Middle Way, Madhyamakavatara. But then if you look at his commentary on Guhyasamaja, he says, he says something quite different. He has to comment on Guhyasamaja and its concept of how our five aggregates or the five elements are already enlightened Buddhas, male and female Buddhas. So even in case of Chandrakirti, I think his Madhyamaka Avatara position seem to be more provisional and not definitive, but his take on Guhya Samaja would be more definitive.
Mm-hmm. That's because way of understanding. Because if that time, if Chandrakirti and Nagarjuna didn't emphasize on emptiness so much, then Buddhist teaching would be almost like become like a Hindu teaching. No?
Mm-hmm.
So to differentiate that or to make that clear, to first understand Buddha nature, then to choose between the clarity and the emptiness. I think then our first approach has, as Buddha also taught in this sequence, so our first emphasis has to be on understanding emptiness. If you understand emptiness clearly, then there is a chance of understanding the luminosity through dental, kind of like emptiness form, right? But if you emphasize on clarity, luminosity, then looks like our chances of getting emptiness, unless you have a true instruction to understand emptiness, would be able to understand emptiness, or then we can become another kind of atma system. So that's why I guess Chandrakirti and Nagarjuna was emphasizing so much on emptiness.
That's very, very interesting. I was reading a commentary on Julama, the ultimate continuum, by someone called Lodak Dharmasinghe recently. We don't quite know who he is. There's no information available. And this commentary has only come out recently from the Drepung Library, which has been recently discovered and books being digitized and published by Pelsek, the Ancient Manuscripts Project in Hasa. And in that commentary, Lodak Dharmasinghe responds to this question. The question, why did the Buddha in the third turning teach about a real Buddha nature after teaching emptiness and illusory nature of things in the second turning? And he says, that's because if the teachings on emptiness and illusory nature were not given before the teachings on Buddha nature, then people will be prone to sort of getting attached to an idea of self and a sort of true real nature of things. That's why the Buddha turned this second wheel on emptiness and illusory nature. And then after having done that, he is now revealing the third turning. So exactly as Kempo, you mentioned, his response was because if emptiness were not taught before Buddha nature, then people would cling to this idea of self or Atman. I think at this point, Kempo, I would like to open it to the audience if there are questions from others. And then if there aren't, I will come back again to you with some questions. So let's see if there are questions from our Zoom audience or the Facebook audience. Marcus, any questions?
Let's wait one moment, see if any questions come in. At the moment, there's no special questions popping up yet.
So while people send their question, there is somebody who's raised his hand or her hand.
They need to use the Q&A at the bottom of the Zoom screen. You can click on that and ask a question, or you can set it in the chat too. I can see it there.
So while we wait for questions, Gambola, I want to ask you, since you have been teaching both in the traditional Shendra context and also now in a modern Western Dharma Center context, what kind of differences do you find? What kind of challenges do you face? Or what are the advantages, disadvantages you face? Can you share the experience between these two different teaching of cultures or teaching areas?
Yeah, of course, when you teach in a shelter, you have to be, present that in an academic way with, emphasizing on based mainly on, in context with some scriptures and logic, of course, to the best you can. But in the West, when I'm teaching, mostly as our Dharma centers are practice oriented, we just go through our regular practice, like Gondo and other things, mind trainings. And that time, instead of trying to refer on some kind of an scriptural authority, I try my best to either relate that with some stories of that I heard from my teachers, or sometimes some of my ordinary experiences that in that way, so it not make it as an abstract thing, but make it more kind of an experience thing.
Yes, I'll come back to you with more questions on this, but I think we have questions now on
Q&A. There's a number of questions coming through now. Thank you for waiting. Maybe we should start with the Sema first, I guess. There's a little question here that says, pot is not empty of pot, but empty of inherent existence. What is the fault in this statement? Going back to the debate courtyard.
So I usually say that in terms of if you want to vote, so you have one tradition, the Gelug tradition, who says this, and then there are many writings on Sajja scholars, how they refute this, and then there's Kajupa and Nyingmapa. So one and three line up. So in terms of our modern way of, so we win the vote. And then why it is so is, another reason is why Nyingmapa, especially our, Mihwan Rinpoche emphasizes on this reputation is, if the pot is left as it is, and then you are looking for something other than the pot that being negated, then your clinging to this pot will never go away by all these reasonings. You still keep the pot as it is, and then you're trying to refute something which is not the pot. So, and that's one reason. And another reason is, in our ordinary mind, when we cling to a pot, we don't see the pot and then the inherent existence of the pot as separate. We see it as one, and then to whatever you're clinging, that is the object of negation. So it all comes with, Lamgi Kauja, Ripi Kauja, was that? What is to be negated by reasoning, what is to be negated by the pot. So what is to be negated by reasoning is, if you are angry with that, let's say, what Mihwan Rinpoche says is, if you are angry with one a person, and you can say that, oh, the sky is empty, that doesn't help you to manage your anger management, So you have to see that, or see why I'm angry, why that person is making me angry. And in that way, then the object to which you get, you have attachment or aversion, that has to be brought in the subject of discussion, not something other than that.
That's why. Yeah, Yeah, thank you, Kimbo. I also happen to write a thesis on this. So if you're interested, my book, Mipham's Dialectics and Debates on Emptiness, primarily deals with the non-Gelugpa critique of the Gelugpa position that pot is not empty of pot, but empty of inherent existence. And I think, as Kempala pointed out, there is this major sort of soteriological problem in that, you know, instead of getting rid of attachment to the pot, we'll end up sort of looking for some straw man inherent existence that can't be found anywhere. And it's not only a concern of the non-Gelug scholars. I think even Gelug scholars like Changcha Rinpoche Dorje has expressed concern that one may never be able to get rid of attachment to things if we only negate a hypostatic inherent existence and not the real things that we come across or we use in life. And the other very important part to this is emptiness, from Nagarjuna's point of view or from Chandragirti's point, from the sort of ultimate point of view, is free from all extremes. Inherent existence is only considered one extreme. So people like Mipham would say that Tsongkhapa put so much focus on eliminating just the first extreme of existence, but we have to also go beyond the second extreme of non-existence, the third of both, and the fourth of neither, in order to touch the true emptiness that is free from all extremes and elaborations. So I think there are also quite a lot of philosophical problems in just focusing on the emptiness of inherent existence as the ultimate emptiness. Anyway, let's move on.
Great, thank you. That sort of simple question was actually perfect.
Well, it's many centuries of debate in Tibet, so it's that's not right. A very simple question.
We were debating on it.
Yeah. So maybe related to some of that, someone's asking, could you explain a little bit more about what is unique about Mipham Rinpoche's commentary on the Gyulama? What's it sets it apart from others? What are the special features of Mipham Rinpoche's commentary on Gyulama?
So Mipham Rinpoche, you're asking me, right? Mipham Rinpoche's commentary on Gyulama is, I would say, he didn't really write it in one sense. So it was when he taught Gyulama, his student then had this notes, and later on it was compiled as his commentary. But he touched the main point of Gyulama, which is the three reasonings to prove that all sentient beings have Buddha nature. So that one he wrote a separate commentary known as Tomtin Sengengaro, the lion's roar of, I don't know how it is being
Lion's roar and exegesis on Buddha nature. So the Shikning Bi Tongtin Sengengaro.
So that's his actual commentary on Buddha nature, which is the key point of Uttara Tantra.
Yeah, so just a clarification, Mipham didn't seriously write a full commentary on the Uttara Tantra or the Ultimate Continuum, but he chose to write that separate exegesis highlighting the importance of the three reasonings and then explaining, of course, in the process, his understanding of Buddha nature. What we have in his collected writings as a commentary on the Gyulama, it's, I think, his notes and teachings, as Kempala explained, compiled by his students. So it's not a serious work by Mipham himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. There's another question here, more about practice. The question is, can Kempala please speak to us about the Nyingmapa vision of meditation and Buddha nature? So how do you think about Buddha nature in terms of practice and meditation in your tradition?
That's the question I wanted to ask you, Kenpo. So please explain how you bring Buddha nature in your own daily practice. And of course, share the other Nyingma meditation traditions connected to Buddha nature.
So in Nyingma tradition, so every practice you can say is based on Buddha nature. As I was saying in the very beginning, the ground is the Buddha nature. The path is the way to clear all the obscurations, adventitious obscuration on Buddha nature. And the fruition is just the clean part of the Buddha nature, you know. But when Buddha nature is obscured in our karma and afflictive emotions, so it's called as an essence, the Shik Nyingpo. And then in the practice of Ngondo, that's one of our main practice, right, in Kaju and Nyingma. So that Ngondo is a way of purifying our karma and afflictive emotions so that you have enough, you know, purification of this karma and the accumulation of the merit. As all our practices is about purifying karma, emotions, and accumulate merit. And as you go, then in the when you go to the real Tantra teaching, then what we have is we have the Kerim, the generation stage, Dzogrim, the completion stage. So then when you're doing these deity yoga practices, so all the deities that we try to visualize or we wish to in this deity yoga practices is as this Buddha nature has an, you know, dynamic possibility to manifest into any forms, whether if peaceful forms, wrathful forms. So you are visualizing yourself as a deity. In a sense, it is just the reflection on Buddha nature. So our generation stage is also based on Buddha nature. It's not just an imagination. It's not just a conceptual construct, but it is, for the beginner, it's a conceptual construct, but it is a way to reflect on the, you know, the dynamic energy or, you know, the cell of the Buddha nature. In Tibetan is called cell, you know, Rigpa cell or Rigpa Rama, self-projection. And then in the completion stage, which is now can also be like, again, different forms of completion stages. So that is sometimes completion stage is based on working with your wing and channel. So that's also the Buddha nature has manifested out in the form of a pure essence of this wing and channel. So we are trying to clarify on it, purify that and perfect it. And then we have this now, the the non-characterized completion stage, that's mainly on the emptiness aspect of the Buddha nature. So in that sense, then this is how, you know, the general, the Ngondro, Kerim, Dzogrim works. And then when you go to the Dzogchen teachings, it's also, you know, in our writings they're saying that Rigpa and Buddha nature actually are same. And as I was just joking in the beginning, so according to Uttara Tantra, even a Bodhisattva in 10th Bhumi cannot clearly understand this Buddha nature. So it's a big thing, you know. But in Nyingma, as I was just joking, we found a way to bypass all those. And then when the meeting of the right student, right teacher, and right conditions, when all these right things are in convergence, it's not for everybody's cup of tea, but definitely then Dzogchen teaching says that such introduction as an ordinary person, you can experience that, you know, even as an ordinary person, because that had been with you from the very beginning, and that never changes. And I just joke that why we are not experiencing it is because we neglect that, you know. Our eyes see all these cool things, our ear hears the music and all this, you know, the sound. And in that way, we are distracted with our five senses and never pay attention inward to ourselves. So that's why it becomes difficult to realize this Buddha nature or the Rigpa, but it's definitely possible to experience that even as an ordinary person in the Nyingma tradition. So this is how basically, you know, all practices are just hovering around Buddha nature in different aspects.
Thank you. Yeah, interesting. So there's another question coming in. When someone gets a glimpse of Buddha nature, does he or she need to put sustained effort or constant effort to sustain that nature through meditation or being aware of it? Or does it get back to square one if we've failed to put in an effort to sustain it?
Yeah, but that needs to put effort. That one, Longchenpa has clearly said that, you know, if even if you have recognized that, then you still need to safeguard that. For example, he uses that it's like a child lost in the admission the battlefield. So all those, you know, bullets are coming around, and then you have to find a way to stay safe. And then in our the terminology too is saying that mosheva, because telzokba, tembatoba, three stages of the practice, how you develop. So first you need to recognize, and after the recognition, then you have to tell Dzogba is how to say that. Now you have to train yourself to perfect it. And after that, then you have to then you reach the stage of stability. So just recognition can happen, but then definitely we have to, you know, you have to put effort to remain in that state. Otherwise, then we can easily fall back to our samsaric habits, ordinary habits. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. So here's another sort of specific question about Atman versus Atmaguna. What is the distinction between the Atman in Hindu philosophy and the Atmaguna associated with the Tathagatagarbha teachings?
Yeah. Atmaguna. Atma, I understand. Atmaguna. Do we use that terminology, Atmaguna? I'm new to this term. Atma, I know, yeah. But Atmaguna, I'm not. Nice.
I don't think the term Atmaguna is specifically or as it is used in the Tathagatagarbha teachings, but guna certainly the qualities.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
The Buddha gunas.
Buddha guna. Yeah, you can say Buddha gunas, but not the Atma gunas, I guess. So that is, again, that's all, again, it's a whole thing about this the Shentong part, you know, and Rangdong Shentong begin. So the main thing I would say is now, in Nyingma presentation of the Tathagatagarbha, Tathagatagarbha is also empty. You know, it is there, but it is empty. And if you, so why it, it the whole thing about all this, you know, Rangdong, Shentong, and why there has to be refutation is, first, we think that there is, in our general human psychology, we think that there is something real. Once you think that there is something real outside existing, then to that entity or the thing, you can have three reactions, either aversion, attachment, and neutral. So mm-hmm. if there is something that is real, really existing there, then there's no way that we can have either attachment, free from attachment, aversion, and the neutral, emotions reaction to that thing. But in that case, then no liberation is possible, because if there's something which is real, really existing, and then we try to run away from it or go far, so then we'll have this constant chain of reaction, and there won't be an end to our emotional disturbances. So right now we emphasize on so much on emptiness is because there is nothing that is really inherently existing in the phenomena. And our mind take it as existence. So there is a clash, you know, we are deviating away from the truth. So the whole point is to, you know, why we are emphasizing on emptiness is everything is empty. Therefore, if we remain in emptiness and our mind becomes one with emptiness, then there will be the cessation of all these emotions. Mm. So that's why then in the same way, then in the difference between the Atma and Buddha nature or, Tathagat Garbha would be that Tathagat Garbha, according to Nyingma understanding, is also in its nature, it is empty, not that, we need to understand that as emptiness also, you know, from our form to all the way to Buddha nature is seen as emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I may also add to this, I think, you know, there is this constant debate about Buddha nature being a kind of a Atma in disguise being brought into Buddhism. And then there is this counter argument about how Buddha nature is quite different from Atman, and there are a lot of arguments and distinctions being made. But in the end, I think what really matters is what do you mean by Atman or Buddha nature or Tathagata Garbha? And I think Buddhist scholars seem to all agree that the true sort of Buddha nature, the state of Buddha nature, should be free from any conceptual constructions and elaborations, that the mind should be thoroughly stilled. It should be totally without any prapancha, no? It should be nishprapancha, tudel, free from all elaborations. And if one really hits that point, whether one calls that an Atman or Buddha nature or whatever, you probably get that reality. And a lot of the more sort of absolutist, mystical presentation of Buddha nature or Buddha nature even as Atman, using the term Atman, is done based on meditative experience more than intellectual analysis. So maybe when people really get to that point, now when they have that mystical experience, it doesn't matter what you want to you call it, Atman or Buddha nature or my nature of your mind, you probably get it. But if you are caught up in the conceptual construction, in this conceptual structures that we built, then irrespective of whatever term we use, maybe we are still caught in this world of clinging and attachment to something as real. So sometimes this whole debate about Buddha nature being Atman or not Anatman, it seemed to all revolve around personal experience, whether one is really genuinely having that experience free from all elaborations and mental constructions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. There's another question here coming in that says, in the Nyingma tradition, is it possible to completely experience Buddha nature outside of an Arya's meditative equipoise?
Yes, that's possible.
Yeah, I think Kenpuche gave the response earlier also. You know, in the Nyingma and the Kagyu, there is this very powerful meditation practice of recognizing the nature of one's mind, or the Lama pointing out the nature of the mind. Semmo, no? And I think in the Semmo practice, you do get a glimpse of your Buddha nature or the nature of your mind. If you're lucky, as Kempo said, if the teacher and the student and the conditions are all present in the most auspicious, harmonious form, then you get a glimpse, and then you have to do more practice to sustain that experience, it seems. So you don't have to be in the Arya's meditative equipoise just to get the glimpse of Buddha nature.
So maybe one final, more general question from the audience here. In Shedras, there's a lot of focus on debate, and then at other times in life, there's more focus on practice. How do we balance these two in our lives, practice and study and debate and so on?
So that is like in either in Shedra, whether you study in Shedra or whether you study as a, you know, practice oriented. The main thing is in Shedra, what we do is we call it like tesam, which is like studying. What study does is counteracts as an antidote to our doubts. And in that way, then we develop that wisdom, we call it wisdom of hearing, or wisdom of
studying.
Yeah, wisdom of studying. So that is very important, you know, to do something. First, you should know what you are doing. Either you go to a shelter or you go to any other retreat. First, you have to know what you should be doing. So that way, then you are trying to collect the information, you know. And then there is a second stage known as, you know, sambhishera, maybe wisdom of contemplating. So that I usually say that after you gather all this information, then you try to synthesize that and then try to see that whether, as in the West, you say that whether it makes sense to you. It's not just you're making sense to you, but logically trying to make some sense and then trying to have some kind of an you know, clearing these doubts, and then you are trying to put it all together to make sense to you, and then you have this, you know, some bishara where you are contemplating, and you have some kind of an experience that time. I usually kind of joke with my, you know, friends that te bishara is like a told wisdom. Your father tells you this is good. So you just say, oh, why this is good? It's because your father, my dad told me that it's right. My mom told me that it is right. But you don't know why it is right. In the second stage, you don't have to say, quote somebody's quotation. You can say that, oh, this is right. This is not wrong because of this and this and this, you know. So then you have this sambhishara. And gradually, then when you have this big wisdom of contemplation, then you can have the wisdom of meditation, which is the real experience. So however you approach this, three wisdom has to develop in this sequence, you know.
Yeah, so something related to this, Kimbala, to sort of wind up our session, I want to ask is, what would be your advice to students who don't have the luxury of going to a shedra to study Buddha nature in detail through rigorous study, but still they need to understand and get this wisdom through study and wisdom through contemplation, as you said, so that they know what they're meditating on or what they're practicing. So advice you would give to somebody who would like to pursue Buddha nature study and practice, but don't have the same luxury as a monk going to a kshetra. So somebody like in your center, of course, they can come and attend your classes on Chulama, the ultimate continuum, which I hear you are going to resume this year again.
Yeah, yeah, I finished half and going to resume this maybe next month or so. But Deva Nigitopar Chas. There's one line, but I forgot. So in Jilama also says that, you know, how you can realize this ultimate truth is through devotion. So and again, devotion as so in that case, understanding or realization of this Buddha nature is possible through devotion, which is in one sense kind of a risky business. You know, when you have devotion, that means you are totally accepting out of almost like a blind faith, you know, like accepting that Buddha nature through devotion. So that's also a way which is possible, but then it, so if you don't want to go through all this, you know, open up piles of books and just have devotion to Buddha nature. And then, you know, so then basically how whatever you do, then you need, we need to try to have some confidence in two things in terms regarding Buddha nature is, so the nature of my mind is luminosity, and all these emotions are just there temporarily. So these are the two things that we need to focus and need try to understand that all these emotions are just temporarily existing there, but not my true nature. My true nature is that luminosity. So these two, that the confidence we have that, and this is what we need to develop. Either you go to a kshetra or you try to do all those TD yoga practices and in that way. So basically, as I said earlier, as a practitioner, then what we need to do is we have the only, the two things, you know, purifying what you don't want, what obscures you from realizing Buddha nature is our karma and afflictive emotion. So in, then you do all this, you know, chanting mantras, doing the prostrations, and all this is to purify this negative karma. And when you purify that, then automatically the accumulation of the merit happens. So as we go on practicing, even by saying one, mantra just once, or doing this, you know, refuge, bodhicitta, or any of these practices. So it's a way to purify our negativity and increase and enhance our positive qualities. So in that way, then, you know, you can gradually, because if you're more oriented in practice, then you can come, you know, practice that with devotion. And then if you have more time, then you can, you know, open up all these books and then try to study under my master to go through all this, you know, the logic and everything, and then try to have the understanding. So only, you know, I guess.
Are there any books that you would recommend, or programs that you recommend, retreats that you recommend for people to pursue Buddha nature study and practice, especially in the Nyingma tradition? Of course, we have quite a lot of books by Longchenpa and Mipham listed on our website. So those of you who want to check on the literature on Buddha nature by Nyingma masters, you can find that on the Buddha nature website. But besides this, if Kempala, you have any advisors for people who would be interested?
Other than whatever is in your website, I don't have any, you know, recommendation of the books. But then
any programs, any teachings that you can direct people to?
Yeah, the any program, any teaching, I as I said earlier, is all about Buddha nature, but it's not called Buddha nature. Mm. So like, I think you have said that, you know, that Mondo in Italy, and then my translator thought that they want to put it into a book. So you have put that, right? So I'd call that dusting off the Buddha nature. So even the Mondo is not say that you're dusting off the Buddha nature, but it says a preliminary practices. But earlier, any practice in Nyingma is related with Buddha nature, you know? So whether you do Mondo, whether you do studies, or whether you do any DT yoga practices, meditation, and whatsoever. Again, meditation depends on, you know, what kind of meditation that you're doing. Like Samatha practice may not be that much, you know. It is a way to calm your mind, but maybe you can also say if you are looking for why you're doing this Samatha meditation is not for your, you know, the health benefit, not for your calming down your mind, but seeking the truth. If you do the Samatha meditation to seek the truth, then it is a process of, you know, getting closer to Buddha nature. So all practices, all retreats that are there, is either directly or indirectly in you know, related with manifesting your inner potential, the basic goodness.
So on that positive note of basic goodness, that we are all by nature, in order to spread this message of positive goodness in us, and then through that overcome the negativities in the world, we do this conversation. So Kenpuche, thank you for joining us, for giving your time, your wisdom, your knowledge. It was wonderful to talk to you. And thank you everyone who have joined us on Zoom or on Facebook. Have a good morning, afternoon, and evening. Thank you, Marcus, for organizing this. So thank you everyone, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.